Welcome to the Annie Jennings PR Poker Pro Interview Series, a poker how-to podcast series featuring the greatest and most accomplished poker players in the industry. Our guest poker pro today is Lou Krieger, author of numerous books on poker, including Poker for Dummies, Internet Poker, How to Play and Beat Online Poker Games, The Poker Player's Bible, and of course the book we're all talking about today, Secrets the Pros Won't Tell You About Winning Hold'em Poker, written with co-author Sherry Bykofsky. Lou, I'd like to welcome you to today's Poker Pro podcast series, and I would also like you to tell our listening audience how they can get more information. Tell us a little bit about your radio show and your blog, as well as the web addresses.
Thanks, Annie. It's great to be back. I'm all over the web, so you can find me there very, very easily. www.loukrieger.com takes you to my website. If you hit the website and go to the books tab, you'll see each of my 11 books described under that tab. And if you hit the contents button for any of the books, you'll get about 2 pages of detailed information describing what's in that book, why you should read it, who it's aimed at, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. For my comments on things going on in the world of poker, go to my blog. It's loukrieger.blogspot.com. So http://loukrieger.blogspot.com gets you to my blog. Every Thursday night, poker journalist Amy Calistri and I have a radio show called Keep Flopping Aces. It airs on hold'emradio.com. That's hold'em with no apostrophes, hold'emradio.com. And look for Keep Flopping Aces. We broadcast live worldwide in real time on the Internet. It airs each Thursday night, 6 o'clock Pacific time, 9 o'clock Eastern time, and if you're in any other part of the world, just adjust the time zones and you can listen to us. Those shows are also available for later listening in the station's archives, as well as a podcast via iTunes, so you can listen to the shows whenever you want.
Well, that sounds wonderful, Lou, and I certainly encourage everyone to go and listen and learn. As you know, Lou is a wonderful presenter of information. In fact, we're going to continue our series. We were talking last time about the tactics, strategies, and ploys every poker player should know. So we covered how to play with a fish, the free card raise, the idea of mixing up your play, the pros and cons of limping into a pot, when you should do it and when you should not. Now, we have some really good information coming next, and this is also included from the Secrets the Pros Won't Tell You About Winning Hold'em Poker, Lou's new book. And I'd like to talk about what should you do if you have a big hand and someone raises. For example, let's say you've been dealt a good hand, a big hand, a pair of queens or higher, perhaps an ace king, and someone raises in front of you. How do you want to play the hand? Do we re-raise? Do you want to bring aggressive play tactics to a newer and higher level? So what do you do now? You're sitting with a great hand, and you're thinking, okay, how am I going to play this hand? And meanwhile, out of nowhere, comes a very big raise right before you.
You know, it depends on how big a hand you have. It depends on whether you're playing in a tournament or a cash game.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in a tournament, it depends on how many chips you have remaining in front of you. And you have to start with the realization that there is a gap between the kind of hand you will raise with and the kind of hand you will call a raise with. It takes a stronger hand to call a raise than it does to do the raising in the first place. And the reason for this is that if you raise, you've got a couple of ways to win. You can win because you have the best hand and it holds up. You can win because your initial raise makes a better hand fold. And to call a raise, you don't have that folding equity. You don't have the potential of winning the pot because somebody else is folding. In fact, somebody else has already raised. So you would need a better hand to call a raise than to raise with. For instance, you're playing in a game and you've been dealt King Jack or King 10. and you're thinking, boy, nobody's in the pot yet. When it gets around to me, I am going to raise. And the person to your immediate right, who acts right before you, he raises instead.
Right.
Now, at this point, it doesn't matter whether it's a tournament or a cash game. Unless that player is a real maniac who's prone to raise with anything, you know, he's just as likely to raise with 9-4s with a pair of aces. But if he's a normal player whose raises you respect, when you think about the hands he's likely to raise with, what are they? Well, he's going to raise with ace-ace, king-king, queen-queen, jack-jack, 10-10, ace-king, ace-queen, etc., etc., etc. The vast majority of hands that you think he will raise with are much better than king-jack. So you're calling him with a hand that's way down at the bottom of the spectrum of hands that he would raise with.
Mm-hmm.
You're not trying to put him on a hand at this point. You're really playing against a spectrum of hands that he would typically raise with. And if you're down at the bottom of the barrel of that spectrum, throw your hand away, save yourself some money, and you be the raiser when you have a chance to be, and then watch him throw his hand away. So you have that gap concept working against you because you don't want to call unless you have what you think is a stronger hand.
A stronger hand.
The raiser has.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to throw your hand away.
You know, I have one of the dilemmas that, or one of the challenges a lot of new players have, and maybe even some others too, with more experience, find it very hard to get away from, let's say, a pair of queens or an ace-king. Why do you think this is, Lou?
Well, I think it's obvious. You don't get a pair of queens very often.
That often, right?
It's the third best hand you can be dealt before the flop, so you don't get it very often, and
mm-hmm.
you know, you look at it, you fall in love with it, you don't want to throw it away, and sometimes you shouldn't throw it away. Suppose you're in a poker tournament. Suppose you have 12 or 15 times the big blind left. You're
mm-hmm.
getting close to being short stacked.
Right.
You're not quite there yet. You got a pair of queens, and somebody raises. You have only one move. At that point, you're going all in for all your chips, which guarantees you a couple of things. You know, first of all, your queens may be a better hand, and if somebody has made a raise with ace-king or ace-queen, you're a favorite. Not a big favorite, but you're favored, and that initial raiser is the underdog. The other thing is, by going all in, you have guaranteed that you're going to get to see all five cards in hopes of improving your hand. If you just called with a pair of queens and the flop contained an ace and your opponent bet out
mm-hmm.
at you, and now you've got only, you know, seven times the big blind
left. Right, you'd be tempted, yeah.
You'd be foolhardy
mm-hmm.
to take a long
mm-hmm.
shot risk
mm-hmm.
by calling with the queens, and in so doing you're saying, I don't believe he has aces. When you know in your heart, he probably does.
Right, so you really do have to just take a stand at that point, because when you are getting short stacked, you have to pick
see all five cards.
Yep.
And you know, you may catch a queen on the turn of the river, which you wouldn't have done had you seen that ace and been put to the test through the rest of your chips. You'd probably throw your hand away.
Sure, I really, and then even be shorter stacked, and then before you know it, you're basically out.
Yeah,
so
that's one time when you can ignore that gap concept. But other times, if you have a very big hand and someone raises, you want to re-raise. You know, if I'm sitting there with pocket aces and you raise, I'm overjoyed.
You know what I find, though? Yeah, at that point they will re-raise you all in.
Maybe, if you're playing in a tournament.
Yeah, I see it all the time.
No limit, and you have a lot of chips.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say we're playing 2-5, and again, we have $4,000 a piece
mm-hmm.
in front of us. And let's say I've got a pocket pair of aces, and you raise. You make it $20 to go, and it's four times a big blind. And I say, okay, I'm going to re-raise you. I've got aces. I want to make it expensive to you, but I don't want to price you so far out of the pot that all I win is $80 on my aces.
True.
So you've raised it to 20. I may then make a pot-sized bet. I may then bet $80.
Mm-hmm.
And hoping that you've got some big pair lesser that's less than aces, and you decide to re-raise me, in which case I'll probably put you all in.
Right, exactly. I generally see that. So I guess I find that unless you're willing to play all in, you got to watch that re-raise.
Yeah. Now, in you know, they have no limit games now with capped buy-ins. You know, you'll see a 1-2 game with a $200 buy-in. It's a lot different when you're sitting with 200 in front of you than when you're sitting with a couple of thousand.
Oh, of course, of course.
Now, let's say it's the same game, and mm-hmm. we each have 200 in chips. Now, you raise to 20, and suppose I re-raise to 60 this time only. You know, you look and you say, I've got 200, I got to call 60, that leaves me with 140. I know that on the next two betting rounds, all the money's going in the center of the table. Now, if you think you have the best hand, you might as well push your money in at this point. And that's what I'm hoping you'll do.
Mm-hmm.
Then we're both going to see all five cards, and then it's a question of whether you can draw out on my aces or my aces hold up and win.
But so let me ask you a question.
There's a lot less at risk when you have 200.
Oh, absolutely. So when you're playing a big tournament, right, you got to watch that trap. That's a big trap because you know what? The action gets a little heated at that moment. Big hands, big raises, you know, all in, call. You know, you can accidentally get caught up in that activity level, you know, the thrill of that particular moment. So we'll caution people against that, right?
Well, you look at big events where there are a lot of chips in play, and a lot of times you'll see players go all in.
Oh, yeah.
With a big pocket pair. Now suppose the flop is, suppose you're playing in the World Series of Poker, and, you know, you each have $20,000 in front of you in chips, and the flop is 9-5-3. Horrible flop, doesn't figure to hit anybody. And you raise with your pair of aces, and an opponent re-raises you, and then you re-raise him, and then he bets $7,000. You know, one pair is no good at that point. Doesn't matter whether it's aces or any other hand. Nobody is going to make a $7,000 raise into a pot if they don't have a hand that can at least beat one pair. So you know that person has flop two pair or a set or somehow has you beaten, and so there are just times you have to lay down big single pair hands. And it's not worth risking your tournament life on one pair.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, truer words were never said, but of course a lot of the true words are said when we're talking about poker, though. You got to admit that.
If you're going to die in poker, you have to die well.
Pick the right hill to go out on.
Yeah,
right?
You do, and dying and dying with one pair is not dying well. You know, if you flop a set and your opponent flops a bigger set, you'll never see it coming until it's all over, and there's nothing you can do about it. It's just one of those hands you are bound to go broke on, but you don't have to go broke on a pair of aces.
All right, now, this brings us on. I got a question to ask you, Lou, and I want your first impression, right? When you see a pair of jacks in the pocket, what's your first feeling?
You know, a pair of jacks is really about the toughest hand to play in no-limit poker. It's even tough in limit. Here's what happens. You have a pocket pair of jacks. You have to raise with it. And you have to raise with it because you want to shut out any kind of drawing hand that contains a queen, king, or an ace. With a pair of jacks, it's just about even money that the flop will contain at least one card bigger than your jack. At least one. Could contain two or all three. And if you get a flop with two big cards on it, let's say an ace and a queen, and there's any action at all, then you have to throw away your jacks.
Well, that's what I'd like you to ask. I really want to get you to repeat that. So, you know, you're saying you absolutely have to raise with Pocket Jacks.
You have to raise with Pocket
mm-hmm.
Jacks. You want to raise enough so you throw, you force
mm-hmm.
Single aces to leave or
sure.
ace rag to leave.
Yeah.
And if a big card comes on the flop and somebody's still in there with you and bets, you pretty much know that the only way he called your raise before the flop was because he had two big cards, probably suited, coordinated, and was able to call on that kind of rationale.
Exactly.
You know, somebody with
exactly.
a king
was
three
able to defend gonna, their hand against your raise, yes.
Somebody with a king three is going to throw that hand away.
Sure, somebody sure.
With a king queen might, and if he calls your jacks and the flop comes queen four deuce, now he's got a pair of queens with a king kicker, probably a better hand than you have. And what are you going to do? If he bets into you, you can either sit there and say, well, is he testing me
mm-hmm.
or does he have my jacks beaten? It's
sure.
50-50. Do you want a coin flip for all your chips?
Absolutely not.
I don't. If you're playing against somebody that's a really great player and you figure, suppose you're heads up at the World Series final table and you're playing against Chris Ferguson or you're playing against Joe Hashem or anyone you think, or Doyle Brunson, or somebody you know that over a long period of time is going to beat you no matter what you do, at that point you're the underdog, so you got to try for a knockout.
Sure.
And you got to try for a quick win. At that point, if it's a 50-50 chance, that 50-50 chance is way better than what
could
you
be
can
the next
figure.
Mm-hmm.
It's way better for what you can figure your chances are if you were to play this person 6 hours until it was over.
Sure.
At which point he figures to grind you down. When you're an underdog, take the risk and gamble with them.
Mm-hmm.
When you're the favorite, let time work for you.
Right. Wonderful insight. So I think Pocket Jacks would be safe to say it's a case of knowing when to hold them and when to fold them.
It's absolutely that.
Mm-hmm.
And the frustration that so many players have, of course, is that they're looking for a formulaic approach. What should I do with Pocket Jacks? Well, it depends on a gazillion things that we've already talked about.
That's very true.
And probably an equal number that we haven't even mentioned yet.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I want to thank you for sharing that with us, because it's really one of those hands that, you know, some people love them, some people dread them. So, you know, I actually agree with you where it's an it depends type of situation. Sometimes I love them, sometimes I wish I never saw them in that hand. But I love the way you presented how to play them. And I think that really is going to help a lot of players be successful or not lose a lot of money with their pocket jacks, so they'll definitely know when to fold them. So you gave us a very, very good strategy there. Now I have a question for you about raising on the button in the sense of stealing the pot, because we've talked about some strategies, and we know that a very important strategy at a certain point, especially in tournament poker, is to be able to increase your chip stack or even maintain your chip stack by stealing, by raising on the button and stealing the pot. Now, before we get to the actual strategies in stealing the blinds, which are going to come in future podcasts, my question to you now is, how do you know if a player is trying to steal a pot, and better yet, should you care? All right, so we have a situation, normal play. This is not a stealing the blind situation, because, again, we're going to go into that in our next interview in detail. But just somebody generally raising on the button, and you're getting the feeling they're trying to steal the pot. Question I have for you is, should we care if they're trying to steal the pot and fight back, right? And if we want to fight back, how do we knock them out?
Okay, of course you should care, because if he's trying to steal, suppose you know with 100% certainty that Joe is trying to steal the pot by raising on the button.
Mm-hmm.
If you know he's trying to steal the pot, it's simple. You re-raise him. If he has junk, he's going to throw his hand away, and you will steal the pot out from you. Will re-steal it from him.
Yeah.
Now, if you're down, let's say you're down to three players, and you've got the two blinds and the guy on the button. if you're going to play a hand at all from the button, you need to raise in a shorthanded situation, because chances are, you know, the blinds are random hands. They don't have anything. So odds are they'll have a hard time calling your raise. Remember, it takes a bigger hand to call a raise than to do the raising yourself, because if you're doing, you're the one doing the raising, you have that equity you gain whenever other players fold.
Mm-hmm.
So you should always raise on the button if you plan to play the hand at all.
Right, right.
If you're in a position where it's a full-handed table and somebody is raising on the button, I think what you need to do is wait for a time that you have a good hand, let them raise, and when it comes back around, you raise them.
I think that what you just said is key. Wait for a good time, because sometimes you kind of just have to let it go and deal with it, and, you know, be able to let go, actually, of a hand, and rather than want to sort of teach him a lesson. You'll get your chance. I noticed that. Sooner or later, you do get your chance. It may not be this hand, it could be the next or the one after. Question for you on playing the blinds, because many players are unsure about how to play their blinds. So, Luke, I'm wondering if you can give us some sort of how to play your small blind, how to play your big blind. Of course, various situations. I know one of the key answers is it depends. But what about in general? Do you think the small blind should generally call?
Again, it depends on what percentage the small blind is of a full bet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in some of the lower limit games, the blinds can be $1 and $3, like in a 3-6 game. And do you want to call $2 when you're in a small blind? Well, you do if you have a good hand. You don't if you have a bad hand.
Right.
But in a 15-30 game, the blinds are 10 and 15, so the small blind is double. It's two-thirds instead of one-third of a bet. Now, if there are a bunch of callers in, and I can see the flop for one-third of a small bet, I'm going to call with just about anything as long as I don't think I'm going to be raised.
Right, exactly. Because you do really never know what the flop's going to bring. And
just look at the math. Suppose there are four players in the flop, in the pot, and they've each got a full blind in there. So there's three chips from each of those four players. That's 12 chips, plus two from me that's in there already. That's 14, and I have to put in one chip. I'm getting 14-1 odds. I don't think any two starting hands are worse than a 14-1 underdog against a random distribution of cards to a bunch of other players. So at that point, it pays to throw a chip in and see what the flop brings. You may get lucky.
Mm-hmm. That's right, and it does. We've all seen it happen occasionally. Now, a question for you on the big blind. Big blind, when should the big blind raise? When the big blind does raise, what do they hope to achieve when raising, and what's the risk, of course, associated with the raising when you're the big blind?
Well, blinds raise so infrequently that the risk is you tip off your hand.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. You know, if you have a pair of aces,
mm-hmm.
and let's say no one's raised. Let's say it's been call, call, call. Then it's back to you, and you can either tap the table and the dealer deals a flop, or you can raise. I think what happens there is if you raise, you're going to lose all your customers of any sort of the big card flops.
Oh, very interesting. So you might want to think about a trapping play here.
People are very wary. You're not going to knock anybody out. You know, it's not a... Anybody that's called for one bet is going to call for a single raise.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not knocking anybody out. It's not a case of thinning the field, which ideally you'd like to do, but that's not going to happen.
Got it.
So you are alerting people. It's, I got a very, very big hand. Now, you can raise from the big blind if you've got ace-king, and you're delivering the message that I have a big hand, and now if the flop comes... all small cards, and you come out betting, it's going to be very tough for anyone to call you, even if you have ace-king and you miss the flop.
Very interesting. even if the small blind stayed in with the small cards. That's the one problem, is you never know what that small blind is in there for.
You never know what he's in there for, and so you have to just go on generalities that the small blind has a typical random hand, which is junk.
Which can pair on the flop.
Oh, he can beat you. And
sure.
You absolutely.
Sure.
But I think that's going to happen less than the money you lose from giving away your hand and betting, and everyone sitting there saying, oh my God, he's got aces sure as the sun shines in the morning.
Right, absolutely. Now, check raising from the big blind, you know, what do we do there?
I think check raising from, you mean check raising on the flop. I think that's a great idea. You know, you're the big blind. It's expected that you're going to check. It's expected. You know, most of the time, the blind doesn't, the flop doesn't help you. And so most of the time, if you watch poker games, the blind is simply going to check. And somebody is going to bet, somebody else might raise, and usually the blinds just fold at that point, and the play is two-handed between the two players who voluntarily entered the pot.
Right, right. Now, I have a question for you about blind odds. I know it's, you know, we could get into a little bit of math here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you want to give us just a brief overview so people kind of get an understanding of blind odds, that there are such a thing as blind odds, and, you know, so how that works. So, you know, the odds they get to call, let's say, or, you know, what they should be thinking in terms of the money ratio to the bet opportunity.
Okay, let's try that. It's admittedly hard to do math stuff verbally when you can't write it down on a blackboard. And
I agree with you, and we shouldn't have to do it at all.
But
we must.
But we must, and so let me try to convey as simply as possible. If someone other than the small blind raises, and you're in the big blind, you're going to get a minimum of 3.5 to 1 to call. And that's because there's one small blind that's already been posted, two small bets from the raiser, and half of a small bet from the small blind.
Mm-hmm.
If there are more players involved in the hand, then the big blind is being offered even greater odds. If there's, you know, one additional player, it goes from 3.5 to 5.5 because you
right.
were called two bets. So at worst, you're getting 3.5 to 1 to call. Now, the small blind has to act before the big blind, and that person has to put an additional 1.5 small bets to call a raise. If you're playing like 20-40 and the blinds are 10 and 20, where the small blind is half the big blind. So the small blind has half a bet in there.
Mm-hmm.
Someone raises, so the small blind has to put in 1.5 small bets to equalize the pot. And he has to do this before he knows what the big blind will do.
Mm-hmm.
If the big blind folds, then the small blind is getting odds of, works out to 2.3 to 1.
Right,
2.3
right.
to 1 is not nearly as good as 3.5 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
If the big blind calls and the small blind is getting 3 to 1, that doesn't seem so bad. But by comparison, by calling, the small blind guarantees the big blind is getting 5 to 1 odds. So, what does all that mean in the heat of battle when you're not going to do arithmetic? You just need a much stronger hand to call from the small blind than you do when you're in the big blind. It's
about
money, and the big blind is getting a better price to
right.
see the flop than the small blind is.
That's right. You know, sometime, Lou, why don't we do a webinar? A webinar, obviously, well, or many people may not even be aware, but of course we do know what it is that people can sort of log onto a computer, put in a little code here and there, and they get to see your screen. So you can actually teach everyone using a Blackboard via webinar format. So we're going to have to set that up for our wonderful fans who would like to see you describe PodOdds, you know, using the format that you feel really helps people understand it.
Now, that'd be great. I'd love to do that.
Wouldn't that be fun? Now, we're going to wrap for today, but I want everyone to stick around for our next podcast because guess what we get to talk about next? And this is the fun. This is a great topic. It's fun. I got to tell you, as you know, very fun to steal blinds and to learn the strategy. It's a craft. It's a skill. It's a craft. It's knowing when to do it. So I want to thank Lou. We will be back on our next podcast with all you need to know about stealing blinds, and we know that's important. So Lou Krieger, author of Secrets the Pros Won't Tell You About Winning Hold'em Poker. Of course, he's written the book with co-author Sherry Bykofsky. You can visit Lou's website at www.loukrieger.com for lots more information. And, of course, to check out his other many books. Lou will be back for our next podcast. Meanwhile, all for now.